Blessed morning, church. Today the scripture reading is from 1 Samuel chapter 5, verse 1 to 5, and from 2 Samuel chapter 6, verse 1 to 15. So I read from 1 Samuel chapter 5, verse 1 to 5. After the Philistines had captured the Ark of God, they took it from Ebenezer to Ashdod. Then they carried the ark into Dagon's temple and set it beside Dagon. When the people of Ashdod rose early the next day, there was Dagon, fallen on his face on the ground before the ark of the Lord. They took Dagon and put him back in his place. But the following morning when they rose, there was Dagon, fallen on his face on the ground before the ark of the Lord. His head and hands had been broken off and were lying on the threshold. Only his body remained. That is why, to this day, neither the priests of Dagon nor any others who enter Dagon's temple at Ashdod step on the threshold. Second reading is from 2 Samuel chapter 6, verse 1 to 15. David, again, brought together out of Israel chosen men, 30,000 in all. He and all his men set out from Bala of Judah to bring up from there the Ark of God, which is called by the name of the Lord Almighty, who is enthroned between the cherubim that are on the Ark. They set the Ark of God on a new cart and brought it from the house of Abinadab, which was on the hill. Uzzah and Ahio, sons of Abinadab, were guiding the new cart with the Ark of God on it. And Ahio was walking in front of it. David and the whole house of Israel were celebrating with all their might before the Lord, with songs and with harps, lyres, tambourines, sistrums and cymbals. When they came to the threshing floor of Nacon, Uzzah reached out and took hold of the Ark of God because the oxen stumbled. The Lord's anger burned against Uzzah because of his irreverent act. Therefore, God struck him down, and he died there beside the Ark of God. Then David was angry because the Lord's wrath had broken out against Uzzah, and to this day that place is called Perez Uzzah. David was afraid of the Lord that day and said, "How can the Ark of the Lord ever come to me?" He was not willing to take the Ark of the Lord, or he was not willing to take the Ark of the Lord to be with him in the city of David. Instead, he took it aside to the house of Obed-Edom the Gittite. The Ark of the Lord remained in the house of Obed-Edom the Gittite for 3 months, and the Lord blessed him and his entire household. Now, King David was told, "The Lord has blessed the household of Obed-Edom and everything he has because of the Ark of God." So David went down and brought up the Ark of God from the house of Obed-Edom to the city of David with rejoicing. When those who were carrying the Ark of the Lord had taken 6 steps, he sacrificed a bull and a fattened calf. David, wearing a linen ephod, danced before the Lord with all his might, while he and the entire house of Israel brought up the Ark of the Lord with shouts and the sound of trumpets. Blessed be the reading of his word.
Thank you, Gina. Well, this morning we're going to be looking at the life of David, King David. As we've mentioned before, there's no figure in antiquity that has got more written about him than King David, and we've been going and see how the gospel works in his life. And today, title of my sermon is Raiders of the Lost Ark, Searching for the Presence of God. How many of you actually watched this before? Yeah, I'm speaking to a bunch of people who know what I'm talking about. So if you remember this, Steven Spielberg's classic in those days, And they're actually looking for the ark, which David now is describing in 2 Samuel and 1 Samuel. It's a golden box, which Harrison Ford and the Nazis are trying to fight over. Everybody's looking for it because it's got some marvelous intrinsic power. What kind of power is it? Actually, don't realize that the ark actually is a symbol of God's presence. This is David. He gathered all chosen men of Israel, 30,000. Now, they're going to gather 30,000 people just to accompany the ark to Jerusalem. David arose and went with all the people who were with him from Baal, Judah, to bring up from there the ark of God, which is called by the name of the Lord of hosts, who sits enthroned in the cherubim. Now, he wanted to take the ark. Now, the ark, this has been stored in this place called Baal Judah for the last 20 years. It had been captured by the Philistines before. And now, he had just captured the capital of Jerusalem. And he wanted to bring the ark to Jerusalem to make it central to the life of the people, central to the life of society, central to the life of their culture. He wanted to bring it to Jerusalem. Now, what is the ark? If you look here, this is a mock-up of the ark. It is the Hebrew word of ark means chest. It is a chest made of acacia wood, overlined with pure gold, and the top of the ark is a solid gold cover. It's called the mercy seat. On top of the mercy seat are the two cherubims, which are basically technical words for angels, and they're pointing to watch each other. And once a year, the high priest would come and sprinkle blood and offer sacrifice to the Lord. And what on top of this ark would be the glory of God, the kabod of God, the heaviness of God, the weight of God. And as you come, what David wanted was not just belief in God in general or obedience or ethical compliance or inspiration, but what David really wanted. Why did he want the ark? Because he wanted the actual presence of God, the experience of knowing God, the spiritual reality of God's approval, the joy of the Lord that comes with having the presence of God in the capital, central to the life of the people, central to his life. This is what he wanted. And why did he want that? Now, if you look in the newspapers today, life of being a leader, Najib, is not easy, you know. All right? People have dog petting also, you got trouble. You know, the lawyers are marching against you. And you've got pressures from all over the place. But if in David's time it was much worse, there are people trying to kill him all the time. They're not just going to character assassinate you, they're going to kill you. And he's facing pressures all the time, everywhere. And he needed to have something solid so that when the pressure got worse, that joy, that strength, the actual spiritual reality of God would grow even stronger so that he could be the king that he is supposed to be. And so this morning, we're going to take 3 points from the story. And one is we all need a real spiritual presence of God, as David had. Number two, the wrong approach is lethal. Number three, the right approach brings blessing. Now, let's start off with we all need a spiritual presence of the Lord. Look at David, look at Israel, and look at the Philistines. There are 3 parties in this story that want the ark. And the first one is David. Why did he want the ark? This is Psalm 27, and it describes his feelings towards the presence of God. One thing I have asked of the Lord that I will seek after, that I may dwell in the house of the Lord of hosts, house of the Lord, all the days of my life, to gaze upon the beauty of the Lord, to inquire of his temple. So here, he's wanting God in the center of his life for God's own sake. He sees beauty in God. He wants to be mesmerized by God. He wants to spend time in the temple. He wants to fellowship with God. And if you look in this, the rest of the psalm, for he will hide me in his shelter in the day of trouble. He will conceal me under the cover of his tent. He will lift me up high upon a rock. These words describe the presence of God in his life provides protection, real, tangible protection against his enemies. Victory. Now my head shall be lifted up above my enemies around me. I will offer in his tent sacrifices, shouts of joy. I will sing and make melody of the Lord. And what he wants is confidence. What he wants is assurance. What he wants is joy. He wants to have a situation where his joy and the spiritual reality of God is not dependent on circumstances. He wants a joy that is so deep that when pressure comes in, that joy even grows deeper and stronger. You know, we all can have joy because you have got success. You can have joy because you have fame. What happens when the success goes away? What happens when the fame goes away? What happens when the security goes away? No, then your joy goes away. But he wants something deeper so that when the success goes away, when the accolades go away, when the money is all dried up, that joy is stronger. That's a spiritual reality of God which you cannot see. You can't look at a bank account and see all the zeros and say, that's my security. Because one day, that will be gone. So he wanted to be God's real spiritual presence in his life. But where was the ark? Let me tell you a story of the ark. The Israel also wanted the ark. This is 20 years ago. 20 years ago, Israel went out on a battle against the Philistines. They encamped at Ebenezer. The Philistines encamped at Aphek. The Philistines drew up in a line against Israel, and the battle spread. Israel was defeated before the Philistines, who killed 4,000 men on the field of battle. And when people came to the camp, the elders of Israel said, "Why has the Lord defeated us today before the Philistines? Let's bring the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord here from Shiloh so it may come amongst us and save us from the power of our enemies." Israel wanted the ark in the face of defeat because they know that this is the nuclear option. When all things fail, you bring God, right? And God's going to fix the Philistines because Philistines don't have God. So they brought up God. In fact, they were so confident. So the ark of the covenant came to the camp. All Israel gave a mighty shout. Whoa! Just like the youth like to shout, all right? And the earth resounded, a huge, thunderous shout. And what happened? So the Philistines fought. Israel was defeated again. They fled, every man to his home. And there was very great slaughter. 30,000 foot soldiers of Israel fell. And the Ark of the Lord was captured. And the two sons, Eli, Hophni, and Phinehas, died. A disaster. You bring up your nuclear weapon, nothing happens. In fact, they wall up the nuclear weapon. They came and took the nuclear weapon away. And so if you look at Israel, their desire for the presence of God was an expedient desire. You might sound familiar. They never sought the Lord before the battle. Only when they lose, they ask of, where is God? Only when in trouble, you start praying, where is God? Before the trouble, at least the Form 5 students asked to be prayed before the SPM, right? So I think they're a bit better than the Israel. Israelites failed the exam, then only ask for God, you know. And then you've got, they only look at him as a last option. We always call this the Hail Mary pass. The Hail Mary pass in American football is when everything else is going to die. You know, everybody is gone, and you only got one quarterback. And what he does, almost upon him, he'll throw this ball all the way to the front, and some bright fellow will be there, he'll catch it. Instead of losing, they will win. God is always taught as a Hail Mary pass. It's the last option. It's the one that you think of. You're in a foxhole, you're going to die. That is Israel's requirement for the presence of God. I wonder this morning if some of us have that kind of attitude towards God. Then you've got the Philistines. What is their desire for God? Why did they want the ark? Read. When they had learned that the ark of the Lord had come into the camp, the Philistines were afraid. They said, "Oh, God has come into the camp." And they said, "Woe for us. Nothing like this has ever happened before. Woe to us. Who can deliver us from the power of these mighty gods? These are the gods which struck the Egyptians with every sort of plague in the wilderness." The Philistines recognized that the God of Israel is a powerful God. This is the one that brought 10 plagues. Egypt was a superpower. And so therefore, when the ark comes to the camp of Israelites, they were shaking. So they knew that they wanted the ark because the ark had great power. And so they had a big battle. They won the battle. And so therefore they took the ark to Ashdod, their capital, and kept it there. So they had a superstitious desire for God. The ark was nothing more than war booty. After all, it's gold. It's a symbol of their triumph. It was a talisman. Maybe I can use it next to my God. Is your God? I got more gods. The more gods you have, the better, isn't it? Right. So they've got a superstitious idea of God. And their aim is actually to control God. And many people want religion in their lives, not because they want to follow religion, but they use the religion for their own gain. You want to get married, want to have a good family, but you go to the temple, and then you know those joss stick you throw, then you pick a good one. If it's no good, you pick another one. Until you pick a good one, right? Because you want to have God in your life, religion in your life, so you cover all your bets, right? And so therefore you can control God. So here you've got three kinds of people. You've got David, you've got Israel, and you've got Philistines. And all three have a different motive for the presence of God in their lives. Of course, the movie is the one, the third one, when you want the ark for its power. And that's no different from many of us. If you go up to Genting Highlands, before you go up there, you see plenty of this. Why? You want to win. And you want to win because very ong, isn't it? Very ong, you must get the power of the gods. Or for many of us, when I was young, before every exam, I was having this. I'll be praying, you know, the rosary many, 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 many times. Why? Because I had an expedient desire for God. God only is relevant to me during my exams. Now, we all need a real spiritual presence of God. The problem is the wrong approach is lethal. You thought you all want God and I could just snap my fingers and God will just have to come. He's always waiting like a waiter, no? But the wrong approach, if you look in the life of David, is different. They carried the ark of God on a new cart, brand new cart, up on the hill, on the house, and out of the house of Abinadab, which was on the hill. And Uzzah and Ahio, sons of Abinadab, were driving the new cart with the ark of God. Driving means walking next to it. You don't sit on top of the ox, all right? They're always walking with it. And David and all the house of Israel were celebrating with the Lord with songs and lyres and harps and tambourines and castanets and cymbals, electric drums and all sorts of things, you know. They're all getting all excited. A fantastic atmosphere, right, of bringing God's presence to Jerusalem. What? It's not a bad thing. It's a good thing, isn't it? Your heart is sincere, isn't it? You're all happy. I'm sure everyone is sincere there. And then they came to the threshing floor of Nacon. Uzzah reached out towards the ark of God and took hold of it, for the oxen nearly upset it. So the oxen stumbled. It was going to fall. He put his hand out. And you know what happened? The anger of the Lord burned against Uzzah, and God struck him down there for his irreverence. He died there by the ark of God. David became angry because of the Lord's outburst against Uzzah, and that place is called Perez Uzzah to this day. And some of you sitting down there think, you see, that's why I don't like about religion. That's why I don't like about Christianity. What a God so terrible one. The ark going to fall down. Uzzah, nice guy. If you were there, wouldn't you be the one to try to save God? In case God crashes to the ground, God himself dirtied. Did a good thing, right? So why did God have to smite him? You know, and David's anger burned against God at that time. And so this is a very troubling episode in Christianity. If you remember the story of the Steven Spielberg's Raiders of the Lost Ark, they got the ark out, and then the Nazis were there. They tied up Harrison Ford and his girlfriend, I forget the name, irrelevant. and then they started to open the ark. You know? And open the ark, sort of apparitions came out, and zoom, zap, the Nazi guy got all stung. You know, I'm thinking he's dead. But Harrison Ford and his girlfriend were tied up. They looked away, and they managed to look away, and then they didn't get stung. Ha ha, clever. And the show is accurate in that extent that, you see, the anger of the Lord burned against Uzzah. God struck him down for irreverence. The issue here, why he got struck down is irreverence, and he died there by the ark of God. The prohibition is very clear. This is Numbers 4:15. It says, when Aaron and his sons have finished the covering of the sanctuary and all the furnishing of the sanctuary as the camp sets out, after the sons of Kohath shall come and carry these, but they must not touch holy things lest they die. These are the things to the tent of meeting that the sons of Kohath are to carry. There are specific Levites that are able to carry the ark. Carry the ark. And then only carry ark, you carry with the pole. It's all covered. You cannot touch it. The prohibition is absolutely clear. All right, it's a picture of how the... And what did they do? They actually put the cart on ox cart. The ark on ox cart. They didn't carry it. And so what happens is that same thing happened to the Philistines. When they actually beat the Israelites, they took it to Ashdod. And there they put it in a temple next to their god, which is Dagon, which is a fish kind of god. Looks like a merman, all right? And they put him there. And the trouble is, when they put him there, the next day, Dagon fell down. Also, oh my goodness, wow, did Dagon, huge monument, Dagon falls down. Then they put him up again. Next day, come back, oh, fall down again. This time the head came off, the hands came off, the legs came off. They got very scared, right? And after that, then you've got everybody in town got Ebola virus, all right? Not really Ebola, but they got these tumors, you know, coming, or cancer of breast, like cancer of prostate, like cancer of backside, everything come out. And it was terrible. It was a disaster there. And then they tried to move it to Gath, and Gath moved it to Ekron. Everywhere they moved this ark, the tumors followed. It was an absolute epidemic of biblical proportions. And they say, we got to get rid of this thing. So they put it on an ox cart and with lots of gold to persuade God to go away. And so God went away. The ark went all the way to Beth Shemesh. Okay? And they went to Beth Shemesh. They thought, oh, these Philistines, bad people, right? Kena tumors lah, kena wallop here and there. Go to the good people, right? Israelites are good people. So they went to Israelites. And what did the Israelites do at Beth Shemesh? He struck some of the men of Beth Shemesh because they looked upon the ark of the Lord. He struck 70 men of them. Good people die, bad people die, everybody dies. You go near God's presence, they all die. Why? Because Numbers 4 says they shall not look on holy things even for a moment lest they die. But this is very random. Some look, didn't die, some look, die. I don't know why. It's a very odd thing. You know, religion, all over the world, we've got all sorts of religion and variations of Christianity. And in every religion, you actually have people wanting to touch holy relics. You go there and touch holy relics, right? Everywhere you want to touch God, all right? Religion is such that it's man reaching out to God. And if you look at the... I was recently in Barcelona, and you go up to this Montserrat mountain called Serrated Mountain, and there you've got a how many thousand-year-old monastery, and you've got a relic there. Well, you'd line up 45 minutes. It took me 45 minutes anyway. And you go there, you see a magical black Madonna. You see that? Right? Because they found this in the cave at some stage, and it was associated with miracles. So everybody's lining up, to including me, and that's my wife's hand. You can't resist. We got to touch the Madonna, right? Otherwise, you fly all the way to Barcelona, you didn't touch the Madonna. Well, I just touched, you know. So, I didn't get a chance to touch Madonna. But, you know, everywhere you go, religion is such that you have to reach out with your hand and touch, and maybe something will come across, and you'll be blessed, right? We all want to handle God. We all want to manage God, isn't it? That's what religion is about. If you look at the ark, and Judaism is completely opposite. You actually have a situation. This is the tabernacle, and the people come. Before you enter here, you have to give sacrifice. And you can only enter, if you're Israel, you only enter to here. You can't go in. If you go in, only the priest can enter here. You're going to give sacrifice. It's like toll. Everywhere you go, you must have toll. All right? And then the last one, only one fellow can enter, the high priest, once a year. And so this tells you, as far as God is concerned, He doesn't want you to touch Him. The ark is telling you He's very, very far. He's very, very distant from you. It's like a huge chasm, right? It is very far away. You are separated. And so the ark tells you there's a difference between God and you. God isn't your body. No problem in our minds is that God is our body. God must be what I want Him to be. If you have a God that That is what you want him to be. You know what it's called technically? Idol. Looks exactly like you, your face, the Chinaman face, your Indian face, your African face. It looks exactly like you. So how can you worship something like that? Uzzah's folly. What is Uzzah's folly? Uzzah's folly is not just touching. He believed that the gap between man and God is not far away, you know, just like that only. And then perhaps he can jump across this chasm by himself. It's not too far apart. He can bridge the gap. And so therefore, when the oxen stumbled, okay, he grew up with the ark in his house. It was in his house all the time. All right? Nothing but a bit of a box. Don't know whether he touched it or not in those days. And it was put on a cart, and an ox cart. So undignified. This is an ox cart. Nobody carries it. And after all, this is an ark that got captured, you know. If God is so great, how did he get captured? My goodness, I've got a captured God, second-hand God. Other people touch already. And then the third thing is that I'm doing God a favor. After all, God is going to fall onto the ground. And so dirty. So my hand is cleaner than the ground. The hand of a sinful human being is much cleaner than the ground which God made. What utter folly. And so when he put his hand on God's ark, he was killed. There's an immediate lethality. He immediately died. Now, God's a bit different. Sometimes you touch or you sin, you die straight away. Ananias, Sapphira, both found out in the New Testament when they lied against the church, deceived the Holy Spirit, they died straight away. Other people, when they approach God wrongly, die later on. Let me give you Matthew. Many will say to me, on that day, which is when the day they die, Lord, Lord, did we not prophesy in your name? In your name cast out demons? In your name perform many miracles? Then I will declare to them, I never knew you. Depart from me, you who practice lawlessness. This is delayed lethality. You're actually dead, but you die only when you die 10 years later on, 20 years later on. So you either die immediately, you die later on, but there is a lethality involved, and we don't know. Some will die early, some will die later on. You know, you recognize this one, anybody? You live today and you don't recognize this? Come on. That's an Ebola virus. Everybody knows the Ebola virus. In case you're walking around PJ, you see this, you must run away. Right? Everybody knows the Ebola virus. Why? Because it's killing people. There are about 4,000 people who have died, and reckon by that, by January, there'll be 10,000 a month who will be infected by this. You recognize this one? You don't recognize it. But actually, this is more dangerous. This is the H1N1. In 2008 to about 2012, it killed 284,000 people. Far more than the Ebola virus. Ebola virus goes very quick. It kills you almost immediately within a day or two. But this one takes a long time. You get pneumonia from your H1N1 and you slowly die. And people don't know much about this one. So you actually have a situation where it is lethal, but you don't know when it's going to be lethal. So here we actually have a situation. Uzzah is immediately lethal. He tries to approach God, but the wrong way. Now, if you think that you could approach God and you're a moral person, you're a religious person, it's the wrong way. You know, you could be morally upright and very successful in life. You know what you'll be? Church leader or temple leader. Right? Because you're morally upright, you're very successful, probably a doctor. Right? And then you become cold and hard. You say, why other people can't be as good as me? And then you become judgmental and proud. And people who are very morally upright think they got leverage with God. Go ka-ching upstairs. How much I sacrificed for God, I got leverage. So therefore, my family deserves to be looked after. My wife's supposed to be looked after. My children cannot fall sick. Nothing will happen to me. I'm almost bulletproof. You see, that's what morally righteous people feel, isn't it? When you reach out to touch God on your own, which is actually lethal in the end, you're blind. You're actually blind to the chasm between God and you. You could be morally upright and unsuccessful. Oh my goodness, that happens to a lot of people. Philip Yancey wrote in his book, Invisible God, of a story of a young woman who is a daughter of a pastor. And both family, husband and wife, died, leaving the daughter to be looked after by the grandfather, who's also a pastor. But she married a fine Christian young man. The word is called fine Christian young man, who then, after 3 months, cheated on her, got venereal disease, got her pregnant. She delivered, and she delivered a child, which is anencephalic, which is born without a brain. Only got a brain stem left behind. And the worst thing, the child doesn't die. The child does not die. It was in Oregon. And a child is taken back, and he only got brain stem function, and lives for a little while, and she's been drained looking after her. And she's morally upright, right? Morally upright, and yet unsuccessful, because want to marry a good husband, good Christian, he was, and it didn't turn out. There's no guarantee you marry a good Christian husband, it'll turn out. Anything can happen. And then you get a child, and you're unsuccessful, and what do you become? What do you become? You become bitter and confused. Why? Because you think that with your moral actions that you could have some leverage with God, and when that doesn't quite work out, you become bitter and confused. And she had to pray through that difficult period of her time. Or the other one, that if you try to reach out to God and you're not successful, oh my goodness, every time you fail, every time you sin, but you try your best, you try to, well, you know, I always sit in church at the back. or the back benches, you know, that would be the one. The front benches are the other one. But all three sinners, all three sinners, the only thing they don't know, they're all dead. They're all lethally dead, far away from God. Some are, and because they're all trying to bridge that gap by their own effort. And so therefore, the wrong approach is lethal either immediately or later on. The right approach connects us to God. And let's look at the right approach. The two-step process in the right approach, one is that you need to realize there's a chasm, and two, that God provides you a way to bridge that chasm. Now, you look at the verse. David became angry because the Lord's outburst against Uzzah, and the place was called Perez Uzzah to this day. Why was he angry? He was angry because God owes me, isn't it? I took 30,000 soldiers. I took a holiday, made a public holiday, got my whole army there. We got everything ready to bring you back to Jerusalem, and you whack one of my men. Wouldn't you be angry? Yeah, you'd be angry. And Uzzah is an innocent fellow, isn't it? Put his hand out there, and he got struck by God. After the anger, he thinks about it. And what comes in? Afraid. Fear strikes in that day, and he said, how can the ark of the Lord come to me? Now, the moment you start moving from being a very religious person to being a person who can be actually in the presence of God is when you start having the fear of God. The fear of God sinks in to him because it's, how can it ever come? I mean, everybody dies, isn't it? The good people die, the bad people die, Uzzah dies, everybody dies. How can you handle God? Now, if you come to a place in your life when you're sitting and you're confused, I don't know how to handle God, then that's a good place. Because that's the place where God will be able to save you. You know, he realized the chasm is very wide. And the holiness of God is very great, and the sinfulness of man is very great. He smites good people and bad people. Philistines, he smites. Israelites, he smites. Everybody, he smites. And the road to salvation is the recognition that you and God aren't buddies. You are very, very far away. And the moment you realize this, then you start to change. You ride your bicycle a little bit more circumspectly at the side with a great deal of respect, and there's fear. All right? The Lord spoke thus to me with a strong hand. This is Isaiah. And warned me not to walk in the way of the people, saying, do not call conspiracy all that these people call conspiracy. Do not fear what they fear. Do not be in dread. The whole issue where Isaiah brings to the table is that we should fear and fear the right things, isn't it? You know, according to most studies, the number one fear in people, you know what, is what? Anybody want to guess number one fear? It's public speaking. I'm shaking here. Then number two, a very, very close two is actually death. So technically, is that correct? Does that sound right? That means to the average guy going to a funeral, you're better off in the casket than doing the eulogy, right? Because you're more scared of public speaking than death. We're all scared of the wrong things, isn't it? Isaiah says you fear and you fear. You do not have to fear the things that they fear. You've got to fear something else. We fear the wrong things. You know, in this country, we fear this fellow. We fear the stock market. We fear GST. We fear Ebola. We have so many things that we fear, and they're not necessarily the right things in life to fear. We fear, most importantly, what other people think of us. Yes, absolutely what other people think of us. This drives us all the time from very young. I remember living in a good suburb in town when I was young, and when my father, who was actually quite high up, assistant director of the meteorological department, died at the age of 40, and suddenly we were cast into poverty, living in a big house in the middle of a suburb where everybody's rich. And if you're a child living in that situation, you know what it feels, because everybody's got money and a position, and you shouldn't be there. You should be in the flats outside. And I had a huge low esteem, self-confidence aspect, and I've got friends coming by. You see, my car has got a red plate, communist. No, that one is the diplomatic call. And then, you know, everybody's rich, and you live, and you're afraid of what other people have to say and think of you. We all fear the wrong things. Look at Saul. Saul says, because he sinned, he said to Samuel, "I sinned, for I have transgressed the commandments of the Lord because I feared the people and obeyed the voice." Many of us are gripped by what other people think. You know, you come back for a holiday, "Oh, I was, where was I? I was in Spain." If you go to Kepong, you won't tell anybody. Right? "But I was in Spain. I was in Kashmir." You come back and say, "Oh, I went to Xinjiang." Paul Dixon also, he did not say, "Oh, I say it's Le Paris." "But the Lord of hosts, you shall honor him as holy. Let him be your fear, let him be your dread." This is the one that you should actually fear in life. Because this is the God of the universe who gave you life, and every breath that you draw now actually comes from him. You should honor him. If you honor him, then he will become, see, and he will become a sanctuary. If you don't honor him, he cannot be a sanctuary to you. If you want God in your life to be kind of the kind of joy that grows deeper and stronger when the winds of tribulation assail you, then he has to be the sanctuary. And the only way he's going to be a sanctuary is that you fear him. You have a healthy respect of him. And so you look, David was not willing to take the ark into the city of David, but David took it aside in the house of Obed-Edom, the Gittite. Ha-ha, put it in the fella's house. My goodness, the guy's toast. Imagine, he kills everybody. Get ready. I hope you've got a good health insurance plan. All right? And then the ark of the Lord remained in the house of Obed-Edom, the Gittite, for 3 months. And the Lord blessed Obed-Edom and all his household. How do you get this? He usually kills off everybody near him. Now he blesses him. It was told to King David, "The Lord has blessed the household of Obed-Edom and all that belongs to him because of the ark of God." And so David went and brought up the ark of God from the house of Obed-Edom to the city of David with rejoicing. Suddenly, this ark not only kills, but also gives life and blessing, and there's God's provision. All right? And so therefore, David did it the right way. He sought the Lord. The fear of God makes him ride his bicycle right at the edge, but in the right way, because then he consecrated the priests. 1 Corinthians 15:11 says, "Consecrate yourselves and brothers that you may bring up the ark." So he prepared it. Because you did not carry it the first time, the Lord broke out against us because we did not seek him according to rule, and the Levites carried the ark of God on their shoulders with poles as Moses commanded it, right? And the third thing they did was they sacrificed, and those who bore the ark of the Lord had gone 6 steps. He sacrificed an ox and a fatted animal. Every 6 steps, an ox and a fatted animal. 16 kilometers, 2,600 ox. Long time, you know. Every 6 steps, kill one. Every 6 steps, kill another one. Huge, huge do. It was a sacrifice. Now, if you look at this issue of sacrifice, if you look at the ark, you have a sacrifice here. You have a sacrifice here. And you have a sacrifice here. Everywhere the ark tells you there is a sacrifice. Something has to be paid. This is the Nangyang Xiangpiao. I only read the Anglicized version. In Henan, 2 weeks ago, there was a story, very interesting story of a love relationship where a boy met a girl on an internet chat room, which most of you nowadays are involved in. They got hooked up in terms of a relationship. And after a while, she got very fed up with him because, used to go out to eat. After a while, he says, cannot go out to eat, like, very unhygienic outside. So we come to my place and we eat. Actually, he's a cheapskate. All right? So, and then the bottom line was, she finally broke up with him. You know why? One day, he brought to my house one roast chicken. And I was so insulted, the girl said. And so the boy's heart was broken. That's the roast chicken. And you know what? He sued the girl. For breaking my heart, I want 10 roast chicken. It was a judge, a big hoo-ha, all the families were fighting because he insisted. His heart was broken. He must have 10 roast chicken. The police had to intervene. Real story, you know. China, really weird. Those of you from China. So in the end, they settled for 5 roast chicken. You see, whenever you've got sin, sin is a debt. A heart broken, there's a price to pay. If someone has hurt you very, very deeply, you just can't forgive. You see, when you hurt someone very, very deeply, it's like a debt. Either they pay or you pay. Correct, isn't it? There's an innate sense of justice inside our hearts. We're all built, we're all wired like that. How is it when right from the young, he took my bunny away, he took my doll away, beat him, pa. We have an innate sense of justice in us that tells us that if any wrong is being done, we can't just simply forgive. Either they pay or I pay. Now, if they pay means revenge, I wall up them. Yeah? Good. And the evil spreads. If I pay means what? I forgive. Or who pays? I pay. I suffer the consequences. And the cycle of evil is broken. Either way, whether they pay or I pay, there must be payment. And that's why the ark has a golden tablet on top where once a year the high priest will offer blood because this is the justice of God that is implanted to us that if we sin against him, we have to pay. Either we pay or he pays. Isn't that right? You can't just, even God can't blink his eye and say the sin goes away. It's either God pays or we pay. And this chasm is huge. And the second step of this solution is that God provides a blood sacrifice. And here we have, thousands of years later on, the lambs and the oxen that were killed are only a symbol of the true sacrifice and provision of God. Thousands of years later on, 3,000 years later on, or 1,000 years later on from David, where by a single offering, he has perfected for all time those who are being sanctified. The death of Jesus Christ is the one that brings us into the presence of God. And therefore, brothers, since we have confidence to enter the holy place by the blood of Jesus, only sacrifice. Someone's going to pay. It's either you pay or God pays. And in a sense, the gospel is God paying the price for us. And then David danced before God with all his might, and David was wearing a linen ephod, and David and all the house of Israel brought up the ark of God with a shouting and with the sounds of the horn. And here is the result of the solution. Because you realize the chasm, you have the fear of God, and that drives you to the provision, which is sacrifice. And so therefore, the difference between the gospel-transformed man and the religious man is only joy. If you're morally upright and successful, you're morally upright and unsuccessful, you're a moral failure, you have no joy. It is only when you realize you're so far from God and God gives you grace and that joy overtakes your life. Let me end with this last story from the New Testament of two women who invited our Lord Jesus Christ into their house. And this is Mary and Martha. And when they were on their way, Jesus entered a village and a woman named Martha welcomed him into her house. Martha, welcome her. She had a sister called Mary who sat at the Lord's feet and listened to his teaching. Two women, one of them invites Jesus Christ to the house. And one of them, the sister who didn't do the inviting, winds up sitting at his feet means listening to the teaching. It is a technical word for being the disciple. In fact, there's a saying that may you always be covered by the dust of your rabbi, which means you follow your rabbi so closely as he's walking, all the dust falls on your head and your clothes. The more dust you have, the more authentic a disciple you are. That's a saying, you know, in Jewish culture. So therefore, Martha invites Jesus, and Mary becomes the disciple, and you know, often never have women as disciples. This is a paradigm shift. This is a break. And Mary winds up benefiting, and you know what? Martha was distracted with much serving. You know what distracted means? You had the initial intention, right? You bring Jesus to layan him, you wind up, what are you doing? Cooking curry, chicken, bak kut teh, pap, you're doing all that, and you're distracted. You're distracted, horrible, you know? And then you see what is happening here. Why is Martha upset? And then she went up to Jesus and said to him, Lord, do you not care that my sister has left me to serve alone? Tell her then to help me. And the Lord answered her, Martha, Martha, you're anxious and troubled about many things. Look at this situation. She's chopping the chicken, all right? And then you know what? It's like most husbands, you know, watch TV, you know. The moment the wife is doing the work, your hand touch the remote control, suddenly you become deaf. Right? And then you chop louder, ta 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 ta, and then you bang all the pots, pam 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 pam. Why? Because you want your husband to realize, oh, you're very hardworking, isn't it, Susan? Come and help, right? Some more, he turned the TV set louder. So you bang, bang, bang louder. Because what you want him to do is to come in the kitchen, fall at your feet, say, I'm sorry, ampun tuanku, and then help you out, right? And so therefore, we call in psychological terms, this is called amplification phenomenon, all right? There is actually a psychological term. So some of you ladies who feel like that, your husband said, amplification phenomenon, don't switch up the TV loud, okay? And then she's upset with Jesus as well as, she's actually upset with Jesus. She says, Lord, you don't care. What an uncaring, ungodly person you are. She comes up to Jesus, taro him. Let me serve alone, my goodness. Tell her to help me. How many of you have been in that situation before? And the Lord answered, Martha, Martha, are you anxious and troubled about many things? Many things trouble you. If you look at Martha, you're distracted. That's it. You're anxious and you're troubled. You know, that describes all of you. All of us have this problem. We're always distracted. Something, I want to go on Wednesday night to listen to the Gospel of Mark, and somehow I got distracted. Huge rain, flood, all sorts of things. My house, somebody broke in. Anxious, trouble, and you can't let go. You can't let go long enough to sit at God's feet, to experience His presence. You can't let go. You're like those people who go bowling. How many of you been bowling in your life? Oh, you're so few. So this analogy, whenever I go bowling, I've got this bad habit. You take the ball, big, big, huge ball, and then you do all sorts of things. You wind up, like that, right? And then you throw. What happens after you throw? How many of you do that? Huh? Be honest. You think you does anything? It doesn't do anything. It doesn't do anything, and yet we're all doing it, right? Because we cannot let go. We cannot let go in our lives. The problem is you want the presence of God in life, but you don't want to let go. You're distracted, anxious, and troubled. And everybody's distracted, anxious, and troubled. You go to a mental institution. They're all distracted, troubled, anxious. The doctors also distracted. How do you tell the difference between the staff and the patients? How do you tell the difference? Anybody know? The staff had the key. The patient's got no key. That's the only difference. It is a common phenomenon in life. And so Jesus turns to Martha and says, Martha, Martha. You know, when God calls you twice, you better worry. Other places call you one time, you know. Rama. If it's Rama, Rama, then you're in trouble. All right? Just Rama is good enough. One thing is necessary. See, there's only one thing. Mary has chosen a good portion which will not be taken away from her. You see, you know, cooking is good, ironing is good, housework is good, sending children to tuition is good. But only one thing is necessary in life. The one that will give you life. You know what the thing is? Is to seek the face of God. In Hebrew, do you know there's no word for presence of God? Do you know that? If you translate presence in Hebrew, there's no equivalent. You know what the presence is? Face. The word is panin, the face of God. And so therefore, what Mary had done, she's a clever girl, she sits there at the feet of Jesus to look at his face, to enjoy the presence of God. That is the only thing that is necessary for her life. All of us are so distracted. All of us are so anxious. But you don't know that the more you do this with the bowling ball, it doesn't help the bowling ball. The answer is spending time with God. God, you know, David makes a huge hue and cry spending time with God. He sends 30,000 troops down. It is a public holiday, and he keeps on offering every six steps and sacrifice. 16 kilometers. How long will that take? But the whole nation stands still because they want to experience the presence of God. How do we experience the presence of God? John Piper says, by constantly setting our minds towards God in all our experiences to direct our minds and hearts toward Him through the means of His revelation. That means always. Jesus is not saying to Martha, you shouldn't cook, you shouldn't go to tuition, you shouldn't fetch your kids. You should do all that, but include Jesus Christ in that process where you fetch your kids because you love Him. You do your job and you do it well to glorify Him. It's all transferred and your mind is constantly geared towards God. C.S. Lewis mentions that it's difficult. He says, it comes the very moment you wake up each morning, all your wishes and hopes for the day rush at you like wild animals. And the first job each morning consists of shoving them back, listening to the other voice. So every day, see, God has come into your house. You can either be like a Martha or you could be like Mary, isn't it? You got a choice. And every day you wake up, all the troubles, the distraction, the anxiety can distract you. But C.S. Lewis says they all rush at you like wild animals. And the first job is to shove them back and say, listen to that other voice. And spend time hearing, listening, meditating, working. Michelangelo paints this most beautiful picture on the roof of the Sistine Chapel at the Vatican. If you go there, and I've used this illustration before, but I think it's appropriate today. You see God, which is depicted on the wall, rushing towards Adam. And you can see the urgency in his face. He's stretching out all his strength. If you look very closely, very carefully, and you can see God's finger is stretching out all the way. You know what Adam's finger is doing? Like that, lah. He's just, honey, kwan lah, ken lah, you don't want lah. That's a true situation. You see, if you take one step towards God, God already takes 15 steps towards you. It's a wonderful, powerful, beautiful God who's the King of the universe rushes towards us and we have our finger like that limp, almost. And all we have to do this morning is just lift it up a little bit and ask God for the longing. Mr. Eckhart says, the soul must long for God in order to be set aflame by God's love. But if that soul cannot yet feel this longing, then it must long for the longing. To long for the longing is also from God. This morning, I want to challenge us. Do we actually have a longing for God? Are our souls set ablaze by the love of Jesus Christ? Is sitting at His feet, looking at His face, the most important thing that will transform your life? Is the spiritual presence of God a reality that gets stronger? The joy becomes even greater when more pressures come upon us. You see, that's the only thing that will keep us alive. 1,000 years from now, nobody's going to bother whether you are the CEO of Microsoft or whether you are Alibaba, It doesn't matter. 1,000 years from now, the only person that's going to matter to you is the most beautiful person in the universe, and that's Jesus Christ. And looking at His face, sitting at His feet, has to be number one. Has to be the thing that you have to forsake everything else in order to be blessed. And Eckhart says, the soul must long for God in order to be set aflame by God's love. We need to pray this morning to set that longing in our hearts. Or are we like the Israelites, very expedient? When I'm in trouble, I look for God. Or are you like the Philistines, where it's like a superstition, God plus everything else? And this is the challenge to us this morning. And if you are non-Christian here and you're sitting here among our midst this morning, you have to realize God is just not your friend. He may love you, but there's a big difference between you and God. In fact, if I ask you, there's a big difference between you and the Prime Minister. Can you simply walk into his house? Can you walk in the house of the Sultan of Johor today? You can't. There is a huge gap. And you have to realize you just can't walk into the house of God because God is God. He's unpredictable. He's powerful and yet loving. He's got this huge chasm that separates you and Him, and yet He's provided a way. And the only way you're going to come to God is through Jesus Christ, because He paid the debt of sin that you owe. Let's bow our heads, have the team to play the last song as we meditate upon this.